write yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Chuck Rasmus. Okay. I want to talk about the election today, and particularly the last presidential debate and things that were said and implied, and what's happened since, and about the debate in general, and to put it in some early reflections and predictions on what this election cycle portends here. We're so immersed in the immediacy of the election and all the charges back and forth that sometimes it's difficult to step back and try to understand what is different about this election and why and what it means going forward here. In a broader perspective. And when I say the election, I mean not just the most recent weeks and months since August. I'm talking about the whole cycle here. What does this represent, and why is it different? You know, most Americans kind of feel that something different about this thing. It's not normal. No, it's not, because it's a reflection of deeper political problems growing in the country. All right. But before that, I want to say a few things on the global economy that people should take note of, and we'll be looking at it probably more closely over time. China, this past week, Singapore, and some other economies, red flags waving, flashing, red lights flashing here. China, of course, big drop in its exports. 10% drop in exports year on year, almost 3% in August alone, and a drop in imports. Now, what does that mean? That means that China is selling less and less globally. And it's not because there's something wrong in China able to sell globally. It's just that the global economy is slowing down and increasingly more rapid. Very important development. That global slowdown, particularly since most of the economies of the world depend on exports and global trade. You know, in the U.S., it's important, but not as important as in countries like Germany or Japan and even China. And when exports slow down, in the case of the biggest export engine, manufacturing export engine, which is China, that means something is happening. In other words, people aren't buying. Businesses aren't buying. They're starting to hunker down in terms of investment and pensions, not pensions, but in investment and purchases. And so are consumers globally. All right, big important development here. China exports down by that much. Another related development in China is that its currency now is pushing against the limit of its band, its trading band to the dollar, 6.7, which means it's quite likely that once the U.S. raises interest rates here in December, I predict, the Chinese currency will devalue and they won't be able to hold it at that upper end of that band, 6.7, they'll have to devalue it. They'll have to expand the band or do something. And that's going to send shockwaves globally in terms of currency wars and perceptions that the global economy is really slowing. All right, so watch the Chinese currency, the yuan, and already depreciated 8% against the dollar year on year within that band, and now it can't go any further in that band, and we're going to see what happens to the band. All right. Third thing to watch in China, real estate bubble once again underway. And in other words, escalating residential and commercial property prices, a bubble in real estate. Now, this is the second bubble in the last 5 years in real estate. When China began to slow around 2012-13, 13-14, we had a bubble over there, and the Chinese policymakers, government, decided to take action to deal with that bubble. So they raised rates and they slowed down the real economy, but it didn't have much effect on the real estate bubble, which is being fueled by far too much liquidity, both domestic and foreign, in China. So they undertook a policy to redirect all that liquidity from the housing sector to the stock market. And that's what fueled that stock market bubble. And now, of course, the stock market bubble busted about a year ago and contracted back down to where stock values were before the bubble. The whole thing went up and went down right to within 12 months. And what the Chinese government is kind of trying to do now is redivert all that liquidity, prevent it from flowing offshore. They don't want it to go offshore, so they're managing capital flight, although $1 trillion did flow offshore. But they've gotten sort of control of that. But then, you know, where's all this liquidity going? Well, it's going into properties again. And into this esoteric kind of a market security called wealth management products. And China's trying to get the private sector to buy up the debt of these essentially bankrupt old-line industrial companies. In other words, transfer the debt from the balance sheet of those companies that are technically bankrupt and should default, but they're being held up by the government. Transfer that debt to the private sector, to consumers, in the form of these, what amounts to a kind of a junk bond issuance going on over there. So, as I said before, and wrote about extensively in my book, Systemic Fragility, in the chapter on China, you got rotating bubbles going on in China. And now they've full rotation. The bubbles that started in the real estate sector have gone through stock and equity markets and wealth management, shadow bank markets, and now they're right back to where they were, real estate markets. It's just rotating bubbles, whack-a-mole bubbles over there. At the same time, China has been pumping more and more liquidity into its economy. 40% of all the global increase in the money supply, which has been massive since 2010, 40%, has occurred in China. That's amazing. Total social financing in China, public-private, is running at a rate of $3 trillion per year. China has added $25 trillion in non-government debt since 2010. $25 trillion. I mean, those numbers are mind-boggling. And as I've said many times, that you know, you can have all that debt increase as long as you have price increases to service that debt and those assets in general in the economy. But we know prices don't continue to rise forever, and economies slow and experience recessions. And when that happens, the ability to service the debt collapses, but the debt doesn't. You see, the principal and interest must still be paid. And that's the big problem. And when that happens, you start getting defaults. And defaults have a big psychological effect on investment and consumption. And that means the real economy follows consequently in the same direction as the financial asset price collapses and the real economy contracts. And that has a feedback effect, by the way, on the asset prices, and now we're in a downward spiral, you see. That's how the financial system interacts with the real economy. And you already have in China 20% of all bank loans are informally, unofficially, non-performing. In other words, not being interest and principal is not being paid on 20% of all those bank loans, right? And bank profits are already declining rapidly in China, 30% from highs or even more. Some banks 90%. So banks are increasingly fragile over in China with all those non-performing loans. Of course, you got the government with all that cash reserves who could probably bail it out if there's a crisis, but the psychological effects both on China and globally will be significant, and even if it's bailed out, you can't stop those psychological effects, which translate into real contractions. Okay, so China, watch it. Big problem over there. And it just keeps deepening, and we'll see at what point it cracks. Another indication of the slowing global economy, particularly in Asia, is Singapore. Just released its data on GDP, down 4.1%. That's a big contraction. And it's, Singapore is a key nexus in Asia, and it's kind of the canary in the Asian coal mine here, showing the decline in shipping and so forth. And we have that big Korean shipping company gone bankrupt, and shipping companies everywhere in deep trouble. Well, that's a reflection of the decline in global trade. And just to comment on the U.S. economy here once again, we are in the fourth longest, quote, recovery since the 1850s. Fourth longest, right? But the weakest historically ever. Officially at 2%, but actually, if you back out, as I've said many times, should be done, the phony redefinition of GDP in the U.S., then we're only growing about 1.7%, which is about half of what is historic average recovery rates. And chances of recession are significant and growing, even though economists don't like to say that. They say 20%, 40% next year. Actually, I think it's significant. I think by this time next year, we could very well be in a recession in the U.S., particularly since we're getting increasingly political risk indicators that are influencing the economic side. And, that's the case here with the Trump. If Trump should win the election, it will have a big political impact, I think. And if Hillary wins the election, I think we're going to have some more political risks, particularly in the Middle East and China, South China Seas, maybe Russia as well, but I'll talk about that shortly. Of course, the economy itself, we have virtually flat business investment. Consumers are still taking on debt, and consumption is holding steady, but the auto industry clearly has peaked and will only go down, and that will have a big effect. It's going to be interesting to see whoever wins what the policy shifts are going to be in December. It will start becoming a little bit clearer, and by January, more clear. I predict, one, that we will have a Fed rate increase, but to enable that increase, they're going to engage in fiscal stimulus. Yes, fiscal stimulus, but in the form of infrastructure spending. Problem with that is it tends to be capital intensive. It's not really labor intensive and hiring intensive, and it tends to be a long-term drag. So my guess is they will pass some infrastructure spending, but it won't be very much. It'll be too little, too late, and more than offset by the actual and psychological effects of a Fed rate hike. Already we see long-term rates rising here, beginning to have an impact on emerging markets as money begins to flow back out of emerging markets. We're talking about short-term rate hikes by the Fed, and they can't control long-term rates, but long-term rates are anticipating short-term rate increase already, and they're rising, and that means we're most likely going to have a short-term rate increase here. But the cover for the Fed policy shift will be the shift in fiscal policy, and that will include infrastructure spending primarily, you see. They're talking about helicopter money, right? That means, gee, wages are growing so slowly here, maybe we got to give people money. I don't see that on the agenda yet. It may be coming, but not yet. But what you will see also as a covered or a quid pro quo legislative deal-making here for infrastructure spending increase will be tax cuts for corporations. You know, big debates between Hillary and Trump, not necessarily, in the presidential debates on TV or even in the public speeches, but, you know, it's on their websites, their positions on tax cuts, both proposed tax cuts. And right now, Trump is proposing more business investor tax cuts, and Hillary a little bit more middle-class tax cuts, but, those are just the two extremes of what will be agreed to somewhere in the middle, probably leaning towards investor tax cuts, that will flow from this election. So we're going to have tax cuts, but infrastructure spending plus interest rate hikes. That's coming. It may take, a couple months to work all that out. Proposals will be made in December and clarified in January, and Congress will have to take it up and pass it by February, March. But I foresee that coming as a way to try to desperately stem off the growing likelihood of a recession in the U.S. Will it be enough to prevent a recession by year-end? We know 2017 will. No one knows for sure. All depends on some of these external political events, of which we haven't seen the end yet. Clearly, if you look in Europe, this Brexit thing in the UK is beginning to look more ominous for that UK economy. Probably will have a bigger impact than people expect. And the Europeans, arrogant Europeans on the continent, are really putting the screws to the UK, just as they did to Greece and Italy and Spain, Portugal, arrogantly trying to make they're going to play hardball with the UK, just as they play hardball with the periphery economies, because they didn't want to make concessions look like they're willing to make concessions elsewhere. It would have snowballed. The concessions would have snowballed. So they really put the screws to little old Greece, as I wrote in my just-released book, Looting Greece. Put the screws to Greece, and they're going to try to do it with the U.K. A little bit bigger game, but it's already taking shape. European Commission's already making hardball statements to the new prime minister there, Theresa May, in the UK, and now they got a flanking maneuver here going on recently with the Scots, who want to stay in the European Union, raising the flag once again that, well, maybe we need another vote whether Scotland will stay in Britain. And so they're putting the pressure indirectly on the UK. UK economy is in deep trouble long term. It's going to lose its one competitive advantage, and that is it's the center of financial industry in Europe. But that's going to decline, and with that, the UK will decline further as well. And then, of course, Japan is just waiting to see what the UK does. And what Europe does in terms of pushing down its currency by money injections, and of course what the Europe and Japan are doing are waiting to see how much the U.S. raises rates and does it for them. But, you know, all this depreciating currency to get greater exports and economic growth is just a dead end because the global economy is slowing down. But that's their main game in town, right? Bigger your neighbor, steal the exports. All right, so that's the global economic picture. I want to turn to the U.S. election situation, right? Second presidential debate held last week. Interesting. In some ways, a continuation of the first, where we have a lot of moralizing going on and not a hell of a lot of policy discussion. Well, you know, that followed up in the second debate, even more interesting. I have a piece out, I think it's on the PRN website, called The Second Presidential Debate, A Political Telenovela in Real Time. You may want to take a look at it. I'll make sure I send another copy to the station here in case they want to post it as well. And I'll be looking closely at this. In subsequent weeks here on the show, we're going to have Jill Stein from the Green Party, and maybe even if we can get Gary Johnson from the Libertarian Party, give these folks, these alternatives, at least some exposure. They've been getting some exposure on alternative media, but the mainline media is freezing them out. You know, as important an election as this is, it just shows you, you know, who controls the mainline media in this country. The two wings of the corporate party of America. They sometimes call them Republicans and Democrats. It's a single party system with two wings. It's not a two party system, you know, because the policies that they work out are more or less the same. Whoever gets elected, I firmly believe, you know, it might have a little, if Trump gets elected, a little bit of leaning more towards corporate investor interests, you know, and if Hillary gets elected, a little bit more leaning to the middle-class consumers, but not much, you know. It's just a matter of emphasis, not a matter of substance between them. You know, they're pretty much bring on the same representatives of the corporate party of America elite as advisors and key people in the administration, right? Not much difference anymore. And whichever one wins, you know, it's not going to be that much different, I don't think. And we'll see. We'll see. You know, we saw that with Barack Obama in 2008. Remember, oh, big. Remember, I thought he was going to be a big progressive candidate. Yeah. I followed that whole election very closely because I was writing a book at the time called Obama's Economy that came out right after the election, a couple of years. You know, in fact, the first chapter of that book is about the positions of the different parties in the 2008 campaign. And Obama was clearly the candidate of real estate and financial interests. You know, he came into the race late and co-opted the progressive programs of Edwards, and to what extent Hillary had progressive proposals. He co-opted them and made himself look like he was the more progressive. But as I predicted, as soon as he got elected, you know, he just reversed on all those positions pretty much. And even his stimulus package was very, very pro-investor, pro-corporate. And, you know, Larry Summers and all those fellows recommended and structured that recovery program. And we see the consequence of it, you know, recovery for the rich, the 1%, who have gotten 97% of all the net income since 2009. 97% gone to the wealthy, 1%. Have you heard them say anything about that in the debates, either of these candidates? 97% of all the net income? Look, this is, I'm not making this up. This comes from an analysis of the IRS data by Professor Emmanuel Saez at UC Berkeley, as what he calls a worldwide database. That's what it shows, 97%. Went to wealthiest 1%. Under George Bush, 65%. Between 2001 and 8, 65% of all the net income gains, and boy, that was a big boom period, went to the wealthiest 1%. And under Bill Clinton, 48%. Between 1993 and 2000, went to the wealthiest 1%. So, you know, it's been growing for them. 48%, 65%, 97%. What? And next president, they're going to get 100%? Well, that's the trend. You know, that's neoliberalist policies, neoliberalism we call it, started with Ronald Reagan. Every president and regime since has been deepening it, expanding it, and the result is this income inequality. That's continuing to grow. But do you hear either of those candidates say anything about that? You know, what's the cause of this? Where is it coming from? Well, it's not coming simply because they're reducing wages, although that's part of it. You know, they're shifting the cost of benefits, health care, onto workers, privatizing health care. That's what ACA, Obamacare, is all about. George Bush couldn't do it with his health savings accounts and, you know, his privatization plans, but they're doing it under Obama, just a continuation. Pension, retirement, same thing. Get rid of real pension plans, are guaranteed, you know, per year payouts. Get rid of those, replace them with 401k plans, privatize pensions and retirement. In other words, and what do we see? You know, we've got tens of millions, 40, 50 million people in retirement now with zero interest rate on their fixed income. Oh, but the banks are doing good. Transferring money from grandma and grandpa to the banks. That's been going on for 8 years under Obama. Right? Continued destruction of defined benefit plans and 401ks that aren't earning anything. Unless you want to really take a risk and buy, you know, emerging market junk bonds, good luck when that crashes. And that crash is coming. I predict another financial crisis here before 2020. In other words, under the next presidential regime, whatever it is. And that will wipe out the party that is in power at the time. Yes, it will mean the breakup of that party. We're already seeing close to the breakup of the Republican Party. And should Trump lose, which looks increasingly likely, although not guaranteed yet, then, of course, you know, there will be another Trump party that will be formed subsequent to the election. Already there are efforts to form something out of the Sanders movement, and should... Once Hillary gets elected, you're going to see that continue. Something is called Our Revolution, a movement. And we'll try to follow that a little bit more as time goes on. You know, the people who believe the fantasy of Bernie saying, we're going to have a political revolution. Yeah. No way. Bernie had no intention to do that. Look, Bernie Sanders has been sitting up there in Vermont for decades as a, quote, independent socialist, and the Democrats have left him alone, have not challenged him up there, and in exchange, he votes Democrat. You know, it's a nice quid pro quo. If he was really a socialist, he should have been out expanding his independent politics across the country. You have an obligation to do that as an independent, but he's not really. He's really a wannabe Democrat, I believe. And, yeah, he introduced a lot of good ideas, which are really classical Democratic Party ideas that the party's abandoned in the last several decades, right? We tried to reintroduce New Deal, FDR-type New Deal, Democratic, what the Democrats used to be before they were captured by the corporate elite here in this coup in the late 80s and early 90s, led by the Democratic Leadership Conference, DLC, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party that took it over and transformed the Democratic Party into a neoliberal pro-corporate party, a wing of their party, of the corporate party of America. Now, so, you know, all Bernie's trying to do is say, hey, Democrats, you're supposed to be Democrats, you know. And what did they do? Well, they tried to deep six them and so forth successfully. They were successful in that. You know, they see, the Democrats were smarter than the Republicans. The Democrats really structured the whole primaries in such a way that the challenge from the left could never be successful, you know, with all those super delegates and so forth, you know. And even then, when Bernie came close, oh, they got scared. And they pulled some dirty tricks on him, you know. Wasserman Schultz, W. Wasserman Schultz, you know, led that fight for the Democrats. Scuttled Sanders. But, you know, Democrats have been doing that all along, right? Anytime someone raised the challenge to the corporate vetted candidates in that party, they've been squelched. Remember Howard Dean? Almost got some momentum, and wow, you know. So he yelled out, you know, made a sort of, you know, a yell after one primary victory, and boy, they jumped all over him. Oh, this guy looks unstable, and so forth. New York Times and everything went after him, and really did a trip on Howard Dean. Mm-hmm. How about Dennis Kucinich? You know, who was a kind of a, you know, a gadfly. You know, got under their skin a little bit. Well, congressman from Ohio, what did they do with him? They gerrymandered him out of a job. He ran to the West Coast somewhere, I don't know, Washington or something, you know. They got rid of him. Well, Jesse Jackson, same thing, you know. Well, Jesse caved in and became part of the deal. So they, you know, let him play around in the ethnic sandbox within the Democratic Party. Right. So, you know, the Democrats were very clever. They made sure that any challenge, which they knew was coming, would not have a chance. And the Republicans stupidly dragged their heels in that regard. And they let Trump get in. You know, too many of them split the vote, and he got in. It's that simple. Right? That simple. You know, except Trump, you know, did have his thumb on the populist discontent, particularly on, as it leaned to the right, right-wing populist discontent. You know, white working class, non-college educated have been devastated. Jobs have been devastated. You know, free trade. He's right about free trade. You know, they talk about free trade. Academics, you know, they talk about free trade benefits all countries. You know, it raises all boats. Economically, well, that's BS, you know. Countries don't trade, companies trade, right? Companies benefit, maybe, you know. Most benefit on both ends, and a few don't on both ends, but corporations benefit on both ends due to free trade. But that doesn't mean their workers benefit, you know. The benefits of free trade accrue to the corporation, not to the workers, you know. Free trade lifts all boats. Whose boats? That's the question. Academics don't go there, though, you know. And they contort themselves with all this logical, mathematical BS about free trade to show two countries with two products, you know, how at both sides benefit if they stick with their comparative advantage and, you know, so forth. Yeah, well, you can't show that if you get beyond two countries and two products. In other words, they never do 16 by 16. No, because you can't show it. And, you know, we got millions of products. By the way, half of the products that are traded in free trade, you know, are intra-company, intra-corporate, you know, moving it between subsidiaries. But that's never taken into account, you know, and they engage in all this internal transfer pricing. They never take that into account in their free trade theory. I mean, the whole free trade stuff is nonsense. I mean, the proof, you know, is the historical evidence, and that's people losing their jobs. And that's what, Trump has put his thumb on. You know, I don't believe he would do anything about it, but he's talking about it. You know, he's pandering to people about it. He raised the issue. You know, Bernie may have raised the issue of the 1%, which, of course, has been dropped, hasn't it, by the Democrats? Yeah, dropped. Trump raised the issue of free trade. Well, they're all, you know, whether it's Sanders or Trump, they're all pandering to people who are really discontent and know what's going on now after 8 years. They're saying to people what they want to hear. It doesn't mean once they're elected they're going to do a damn thing about it. I don't think they will. You know, they already got in mind what the policy shift is going to be, and that is more tax cuts for wealthy and investors, infrastructure spending, right, and raising interest rates. Well, why are they going to raise rates? It's going to slow down the economy, isn't it? Could have a big psychological effect, yeah. Well, they have to, because the banks are being squeezed by zero rates. Grandma and grandpa consumption is being squeezed. So they've gone as far as they can with monetary policy, with QE and tens of trillions of dollars of injection of free money into the economy, and that's occurring everywhere, had occurred everywhere, reoccurring again in the UK. It's not working, and it's counterproductive now. So they're going to dump that, and they're going to start raising rates. They squeezed as far as they can go, giving money to their friends, and now it's counterproductive, so they're going to back off from that. And they're going to give money to their friends through the tax system, from the fiscal side again, and through these big projects, which are going to be capital intensive, aren't going to hire a lot of people. Right? Look, the fate of the working class is part-time temp jobs, contingent jobs, gig jobs. I've seen a figure like somewhere that 20% of the U.S. economy now is gig jobs. I don't know how accurate that is, but it's growing rapidly. What is a gig job, gig economy? Oh, that is where companies invent software, and they tell the workers, you want to work for us? We'll give you a pittance of what we're making. We'll find out where the work is, you know, mostly service-oriented service jobs. We'll find out where the work is with our software. You know, now that you all got iPhones and GPS, right, we'll tell you where to go or where the jobs are. We're not going to provide any equipment for you. We're not going to invest in plant and equipment. We have no buildings. The company, you know, whether it's Uber or Lyft or Airbnb or whatever, we just run the software. We tell you where to go. We take 90%. And we give you 10, right? And on top of that, we don't provide any equipment or any buildings even. Well, buildings, of course not, but we don't even provide any equipment. You see, e-commerce, B2B e-commerce was get rid of bricks and mortar, right? Internet-based retail and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, now, the gig has gone one step further. The gig business model idea is we're not even going to provide you with equipment. You use your own equipment. You use your own cars, right? You use your own homes. You pay the insurance. You pay the tax. You pay the repairs. All the capital investment is yours. And we're only have minimal cost of goods, and that's the software. And of course, you reduce your cost of goods, and you get big profits. And that's what's happening with the gig economy. So, but what that means is increasing insecurity. People running around trying to supplement their part-time day job with gig work, or maybe a total gig work. And of course, there's no benefits involved here, no pensions, no retirement, nothing. All you're going to do is get some money, pittance for making the software company rich. That's the gig economy. That's the future, you know. The last 20 years devastated the working class with part-time temp jobs. Well, the next 20 is going to, even 2010, going to devastate it even further with gig jobs. That's the future. That's capitalist labor market evolution. At the same time, capitalist financial markets are evolving to more financial asset investing. That the labor markets are moving in this direction I just described. Well, when you move in that direction, income and wages decline. And the other structural revolution, financial side, is the lion's share of that 97% of income shift. So we got two things going on at the same time. We got financialization, providing more and more income and wealth in the hands of investors and the 1%, and we have changes in the labor market that are devastating the working classes and reducing their share of income. Those are the two fundamental reasons driving income inequality. But hey, do you hear that from the academics? No. You know, is Robert Reich talking about the financial side? No. Oh, they're talking about let's raise minimum wage or let's make education opportunity. You're just scratching the surface of the problem. The problem is the structural change in 21st century capitalism where labor markets are driving down wages, not just globalization of labor markets, but I mean these structural changes in labor markets affecting wages and benefits and the nature of work. And then at the other end, the financialization of markets going on where the 200,000 global finance capital elite now are investing more and more in these financial assets and securities of various kinds and reaping capital gains of all kinds due to speculation in financial asset prices. Economists don't understand finance. That's a problem. You know, they don't understand much. In any event. Okay, so let's look at the first, the second presidential debate. You know, a lot of it was just talk here about moralizing, right? Moralizing. How terrible, you know. And, you know, I'm not apologizing for what Trump said. Trump's pretty stupid. He puts his foot in his mouth all the time, you know. But boy, the media is watching that foot. And every time he puts it in his mouth, boy, they blow it up. I mean, he's right to some extent. The corporate media is aligned with Hillary. You know, the big capitalists don't like what he's talking about when he talks about trade and some of these other things. They don't like it. They feel safer with Hillary. So, you know, I mean, the New York Times has just come out blatantly anti-Trump. They're pulling out all the plugs, and so is the media, corporate media, pulling out all the plugs on behalf of Hillary. And not really going after Hillary and her emails, you know, which is an issue. You know, she was subpoenaed and she burned her emails. That's a felony. He's right. But no one's going after her, you know, and then all these WikiLeaks coming out, right? Showing all these real statements by Hillary to her her business friends, her banking friends, and so forth, saying, you know, don't worry, you know, I'm really for you guys. You know, I'll have to say something, a dual approach, you know, dual strategy. I'll have to say something quite different to the people when I'm running, but don't worry, we're okay. You know, Obama did the same thing, you know. When it came to, in 2008, they were talking about NAFTA and free trade, right? And somehow it got leaked out that, Obama had actually said something too directly about the North American Free Trade Agreement. He was going to look into it and change it, right? Well, the Canadians got a little upset with that, and so Obama's, staff went to Canada and said, hey, don't worry, he's really for free trade. All that came out afterwards. Well, the same thing, you know. What has Hillary said about free trade? I'm going to look into it. Yeah, look into it. Not that, you know, I'm going to strike out this or that clause or I'm going to change it or renegotiate this or that clause or the whole damn thing. No, no, none of that. It's all very carefully worded so that she can backtrack. So, you know, the second debate here, half of, or one-third of it, I think 29 minutes of the hour and a half, was all moralizing about, you know, your videos about women. Donald, you know. I mean, this, all that stuff with the videos and the misogyny, which is true, I think he is a misogynist, is really evidence of why rich capitalists do not and should not run directly for office. I mean, because they have so many skeletons in their closet, you know, not just sexual, you know, but I'm talking about financial and so forth, you know, they that might get dragged out of the closet. They don't want to see that. They'd rather run the show through squeaky cleans, you know, like the Pences and stuff, right? Squeaky clean representatives who aren't all that squeaky or clean. You know, compared to some of these captains of industry and finance, you know, they look like Boy Scouts. So that's why they don't run. Well, you know, Trump made a mistake. He's running. And he was also a businessman who liked to get on TV and video. So they got all kinds of stuff on him. And they're just, you know, leaking it one step by step in the New York Times. And all of them are playing all right along with it. They're just, you know, hammering him with this stuff, but you don't hear much on the WikiLeaks, you don't hear much on the emails, you don't hear much at all about the foundations, you know. I don't know why they're just focusing on these emails. They should look at the foundations of the rich, both Hillary and Trump, because there you'll see some real hanky-panky of money being transferred back and forth between the rich people's foundations and the games that they play through their foundations. But no, no one's digging into that. If I had time, I would, but I don't. Okay. Now, the thing that really disturbed me in this second debate was not so much Trump's stupid statement, you'd be in jail, the special prosecutor. Look, what Trump is doing in the second debate was turn back to his base and shore up his right-wing base. This is Breitbart, you know, the right-wingers who are calling the show. Reestablish his base in the face of all this attacks on him. And that's why he's coming out, you know, he's saying all this stuff about, you know, Hillary and being a crook and Hillary she-devil and Hillary all this nonsense, right? The base likes to hear that. And that's what he really did. He just went back to that and shored it up, protected it. But he can't win an election just by shoring up his base. You see, he's got to win over these key constituencies in the swing states. What are they? They're the non-college-educated white working class, one, right? Two, the millennials, you know, who, by the way, aren't being fooled by anything. They're just turning cynical. Latinos, and he's got to whoever wins those three constituencies by turning out their vote in the swing states. That's the equation for victory here. Those 8 or 9 states, those key constituencies, and voter turnout. Because 87% of people made up their mind already. You know, so you're trying to swing 13%, and you know, who turns out what? Can Trump turn out more of his base, which is smaller than the Democrat base, or can Hillary turn out her base after the base is really discontent with what Obama and the Democrats have done for him? You know, I mean, Latinos are discontent because of all the deportations and the lack of Dream Act and executive action. And the millennials are discontent because of the lousy jobs they're getting and the extreme debt they've got and the high cost of child care if they got kids, etc. You know, and war. Which leads me to this point of second debate I found most disturbing, you know. On this show, I talk a lot about the global economy, right? And the U.S. economy, and U.S. politics, and labor. Those are, you know, my areas I feel I have something to say. I generally don't get into the big corporate global machinations, you know, except maybe the Saudis versus the fracking guys in the U.S. and the oil prices. But I don't get into the politics, global politics, strategic politics that much. Syria, big problem in Syria. I'm not talking about the fact that it's a war. I'm talking about the fact that you've got the Russian military and the U.S. military side by side. As long as it looked like they were both attacking the common enemy, okay, you know, that's risky, but might be managed. But then a couple weeks ago, what happened was the U.S. attacked a Syrian government Russian airbase, and that was a turning point, I think. And it was subsequent to that that the Russians began ignoring the U.S. and engaging in quid pro quo, in other words, attacking the bases, no matter what, where they were, in Aleppo, elsewhere, of the anti-Assad forces, not just the ISIS. You see, and they're all mixed. It's hard to tell who's who there, right? But that's what Aleppo is. And yeah, the Russians are leveling Aleppo, at least part of it, you know, where they think the group is. But, you know, you've got to go back. That's a policy that Russia experienced in the Caucasus, you see. They could not tame the terrorists until they leveled the city of Grozny, you know, in the Caucasus. That's what did it. So, you know, that's what the Russians are doing now. And what you see in the U.S. is increasing desperation with the U.S. It's being sidelined over there in the Syria conflict. Russia's influence is growing, and the Russian Assad forces are winning. And the U.S. Is at a loss. It has no reliable forces equivalent to the Assad military that it can rely on. It's at a great disadvantage militarily, and it's losing, and it's the U.S. is getting frustrated. And Obama won't do anything while he's a lame duck. And the Russians know this, so they're taking advantage of it. Right? And they're pushing it. Well, this is very risky because in the U.S. at the same time, WikiLeaks is dumping information about Hillary, and there's an effort by Hillary and the U.S. Media to link the Russians to the WikiLeaks. Now, the Russians aren't controlling Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. No way, right? The Russians aren't behind this, the WikiLeaks. Ah, but the Democrats say somebody's hacking our Democrat databases. It must be the Russians. There's no evidence of that. Maybe, but there's no evidence of that. But they're acting, and the media is acting, creating the impression that, you know, the Russians are interfering with our election. How dare they? The U.S. doesn't interfere with elections of anybody else, right? Wrong. We do that everywhere. So how dare anybody else interfere in our election? You know, in the Imperial Center here, you know, you don't do that. We do that, but you don't do that. All right, so, you know, maybe the Russians indirectly are interfering with the Democrat election. You know. But I can understand it because, you know, the U.S. is pushing more and more forces closer and closer in NATO to the Russian border, right? They pull off this coup in the Ukraine. You got the U.S. neocons in Hillary's State Department. You know, we're rampant, and they still are. They want to fight in Syria. And what does Hillary say in the second election debate? She says, the Russians are interfering with our election. One, Russians are hacking us through WikiLeaks, right? And we should install a no-fly zone and send in special forces in Syria. That's what she said. No-fly zone, special forces. Uh-oh. No-fly zone. What do you do if the U.S. says no-fly zone? You know, are the Russian planes going to stop flying? And if they do fly, what are they going to do? Shoot them down? And what if they retaliate? Shoot down U.S. planes? Uh-oh. Where are we then? I think we are creeping dangerously towards a conflict, and I'm worried that Hillary, the war hawk faction of the U.S. political elite, may make a strategic error here of great import. Very worrisome. Very worrisome. And, of course, the Russians are now moving missiles, regional and long-distance missiles to its western border, and it's given S-300, S-400s to Iran. I mean, this is ominous. What's going on? If they don't back off, I think the worst outcome of this campaign, election campaign, could be, you know, a military adventure that leads to a conflict between the U.S. and Russian forces, and that would be really, really serious. You want to talk about how that's going to hit the economy. We can do that, too. Right? Anyway, I think that's one of the most interesting things of that second debate, right? And then Martha Raddatz, who was a commentator in the debate, asked Trump, would you agree with this? Should U.S. strike military targets of the Assad regime? In other words, air bases where Russian planes are. Hmm? Trump said, I disagree. Even though Raddatz said, your VP, Pence, has said he agrees with that. No-fly zone, attack the bases. Trump said he disagreed. He said the focus should be on ISIS. Well, that's interesting. Well, that sure pissed off the elite in the U.S., didn't it? Okay, this is read between the lines. What's going on in these debates? And sometimes you get some very interesting developments here. Well, I was going to get into the reflections, my early reflections on the 2016 election, those long-term historical reflections, but we're running out of time here, so I'm not going to get to that. I'll hold that as we get closer to the election here. Next week we're going to maybe try to see if we can get Jill Stein from the Green Party was going to come on, and then Gary Johnson, Libertarian Party. But at some point I want to make step back and say, well, what does what's the significance of this very difficult different election? Well, one is it's a rebellion against the political class, the corporate party America on the left and right. But that's only one thing. We'll talk about some more next week as we continue our election coverage. Alternative Visions.